Lord, thank you for health and strength and for the opportunity to be here. And Lord, we just ask now that your Holy Spirit would just be with us in our conversations. And Lord, that you would just open our minds and our hearts and give us understanding for what you have for us this morning, for what you want us to take with us from this morning. Thank you now for this food and for your provision for us each and every day. And bless our time together now. In Jesus' name, amen.
On behalf of the Peace and Justice Committee, thank you for coming this morning. First, a couple of plugs. So we have a gathering coming up in the middle of October in the Philadelphia Oxford Circle, a conversation between urban and rural folks. And you're invited to come join us. It's, you can see the details. You can arrange for Sharon to ride into Philly if you like. Next slide. And also coming up, and I'll say a little more about this later, on November 20th, we're looking towards doing a full-day workshop on immigration issues where we can have multiple workshops, lots of time for discussion, and have a focus that's a little more towards the general population of the church as opposed to just the pastors and leaders that are here this morning. So, next slide. With limited time this morning, we're not going to cover every aspect of immigration that has become the topic of intense national debate, but we would like to give you an overview beginning from our biblical roots of how people in our congregations and communities are affected by local and national immigration policy. And as Kay said, with me this morning are Maria Beiler, and who works with the Philadelphia Praise Center, Centro de Alabanza, and Peter Pedamonte, who with the New Sanctuary Movement. I'm going to begin with a biblical review, and then Peter will share stories of local immigrants and the questions those stories raise about the current U.S. immigration system, and Maria will speak more specifically about immigrants in our local congregations, what they bring to our church, and what the church is doing to support them. Our time is very limited this morning, so necessarily we're not going into great depth, but we do invite you to come to Tawamis on November 20th, and you know, and we'll have more speakers and workshops and really have a time for back and forth dialogue on the issues that tend to spark debate. Also, at the conclusion of this morning's discussion, we invite your suggestions as to what should be included in that November 20th session. So, with this group, I'm going to assume that you have sufficient familiarity with the Bible that I don't need to fill in a lot of detail on some of the key scriptures that I will make reference to this morning. You know, I wouldn't do the sort of condensed presentation with a general audience, and you're welcome to take notes if you wish, but this all comes from published sources, which are really available, and it looks like it's going to be on the web as an audio presentation as well. So I'm going to start with a brief overview of what could easily become a full semester class, and then we'll move to a particular text that we'll explore in some detail. And let me say from the outset that, like everyone else here, I am speaking from a particular theological viewpoint. I believe my perspective is informed by sound Anabaptist theology, but I will respect any of you who come from a different perspective, and perhaps we will have an opportunity to learn from each other. In fact, what I have discovered in preparing this study is that any supposedly objective study of what the Bible has to say about undocumented or illegal immigrants is very likely to be colored by one's theological bias. But let's start with some basics. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew uses several words which are variously translated as stranger, sojourner, alien, foreigner, etc. And sometimes several different English words are used for the same Hebrew word, and vice versa. So for critical study, it is preferable to go back to the original Hebrew. The Hebrew ger, or ger, the verb and noun forms, each appear in the Old Testament more than 80 times, especially in the Torah, the Mosaic Law, and appears to refer to resident aliens, that is, foreigners who are settled as permanent or legally authorized residents. The Hebrew zor, which appears several dozen times, and nekar, which is used less frequently, appear to refer to foreigners, outsiders, or intruders who have no particular legal status or protection under Torah. The other word, toshav, is used so rarely that I'm going to skip it. Also, the distinction among the New Testament terms is less significant for our discussion today, so I'm going to skip them as well. The texts most often cited by proponents of comprehensive immigration reform and basic rights for undocumented immigrants are Leviticus 19. I think you're ahead of me on the slide. And Matthew 25 as broadly representative of the Old Testament and New Testament teaching, respectively. I tend to agree with that assessment when you take into account biblical teaching as a whole. However, you know, there's credible biblical scholarship which argues that Torah protections for aliens applied only to resident aliens, that is, ger in Hebrew, foreigners who entered the land legally. Also, for Matthew 25, the closing verse, the least of these my brothers, appears to imply that other verses in Matthew, you know, that Jesus is speaking only of his disciples and not Christians or vulnerable people in general. So, you know, we should be a little bit cautious about relying on these texts alone. On the other hand, slide six. On the other hand, the key passage for theologians who contend that illegal immigrants are lawbreakers with no inherent rights refer to Romans 13. That text is also problematic because it is taken out of context, as Mennonite theologian John Howard Yoder argues in his classic book, The Politics of Jesus, chapter 10. If you want more detail, that's a good place to go. So rather than spending the next 3 hours rehashing these arguments, however, I now want to turn in a different direction, borrowing from the work of Ched Myers. Isaiah 56, verses 1 through 8, is the opening stanza of the prophetic oracle, sometimes referred to as Third Isaiah. The parts of the book Isaiah, known as 2nd Isaiah, that's chapters 40 through 55, and 3rd Isaiah, chapters 56 through 66, represent the work of prophetic successors to the great 8th century prophet himself. The former during the exile to Babylon, the latter during the reconstruction period following the return. These writings arose out of prophetic schools in which disciples applied the word and work of their teachers in a new historical context. This is, of course, what all preachers do every time we try to proclaim the word in the midst of a given social situation. So Isaiah 56, 1 through 8, is his invocation, setting a tone of radical inclusion, envisioning a time when people from all over the world, including ethnic outsiders and other minorities, will be welcomed as full members into God's house. The prophet reiterates this theme at the close of his oracle as well. The time has come to gather all nations and tongues. They shall come and behold my glory. This is the new heaven and new earth that Yahweh intends to bring about. Scholars date 3rd Isaiah sometime from in the first two generations of the exiles' return from Babylon, between the reconstruction of the temple, about 1515 BCE, and the time of Nehemiah, about 444 BCE, there were many issues facing those trying to rebuild Israelite society under the imperial rule of Persia. Those who had been exiled to Babylon were the upper classes of Israelite society, priests, managers, and landed aristocracy, scribes, etc. The peasant majority, however, the people of the land, had remained behind in Palestine, working the land and scraping out a living as the poor have always done under any regime. As the elites began to trickle back, they set about trying to reestablish their title to land, social status, and political position. Clinton Hammock, in a monograph analyzing in detail this social and historical context, argues that these returnees were a mixed bag, and included land speculators and carpetbaggers trying to take economic advantage of the new settlements. Priests determined to reestablish a cultic center as their power base, ultra-nationalists who saw a chance to rebuild old dreams of sovereignty, and political frontmen for Israel's Persian overlords. They all agreed on one thing, however. They would define and lead the reconstruction project. Well, it's not hard to imagine, then, that their conflicts with the existing population over property, politics, and religion, and indeed, you know, we hear allusions to this in Nehemiah chapters 4 through 6. We need only to think of the situation in Palestine, the overpromised land since 1948, which is also a struggle between longtime residents on the land being disenfranchised by ideologically motivated and politically powerful military powerful returnees. The strategy of the elites was to purge the people of the land by establishing new ethnic purity standards, focusing on shoring up boundaries of marriage and nationality. The Persians were supportive of such measures as they wanted their colony to be ethnically uniform to better enable their imperial management. So thus, Nehemiah forbids future intermarriages, while Ezra goes further, demanding the divorce of foreign wives. And this position was likely legitimated on the basis of Deuteronomy chapter 3, which specifically included from the assembly males who were not sexually functional, the illegitimately born, and foreigners. Now, it's not quite hard to understand why the peasants resisted these attempts to exclude them. And third, Isaiah emerged as their advocate. He argues against the position of Ezra and Nehemiah, taking issue specifically with their view that the nation is best protected through purity codes. Instead, the prophet calls for community to be preserved through ethical behavior. Whoever keeps the Sabbath covenant is entitled to full inclusion. He underlines the point by using two extreme examples, eunuchs and foreigners. The oracle begins with a dramatic exhortation in verse 1. This is what God says: defend justice, do what is right, then I will vindicate you. From the outset, the issue is justice, defined in verse 2 as obeying Torah, keeping Sabbath, and turning away from evil. The prophet is invoking Sabbath as the heart of Torah ethos, with its twin social concerns to constrain greed and deconstruct poverty. You know, first, constrain greed. Everyone must have enough, you know, like the manna in the wilderness, and the gifts of creation should circulate rather than concentrate. And second, deconstruct poverty, releasing those who've grown under the burden of debt, you know, the Sabbath and the Jubilee years, and allowing the poor to glean the surplus of the fields. But third, Isaiah goes further, addressing those who are being legally and socially excluded on the basis of purity. We hear the voice of those who have internalized this rejection in terms of their self-worth and social prospects. Let not the foreigner say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. Let not the eunuch say, I am just a dry tree. For this is what God says. The excluded throughout history know all too well self-hatred that comes with second-class citizenship. You know, black children trying to scrub their skin white, immigrants changing their names, women keeping silent, gays and lesbians staying deep in a destructive closet, all to avoid the contempt of a society that barely tolerates them. But God, writes 3rd Isaiah, says differently. One commentator portrays the prophet's rhetoric here as implying a new legal ruling on case law. The eunuch who keeps the Sabbath will receive in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Verse 5 is a play on the Hebrew word for eunuch, which comes from a root meaning to castrate. The prophet knew very well that eunuchs were, according to Levitical strictures, supposed to be cut off from benefits of cult and family life, which would mean their names would also be lost to posterity, an ancient way of rendering someone socially invisible. Instead, God promises an honored place in the house, something better than pride of genealogy or title to land. This is symbolized by a special monument and an everlasting name, and playfully, the Hebrew word rendered as monument, yid, which can be also be a euphemism for penis, The only people below eunuchs in the social hierarchy were foreigners, and this is exactly who the prophet addresses. The foreigners follow God and observe the Sabbath covenant. I will bring them to my holy mountain, and their sacrifices will be acceptable, because my house will be known as a place where all nations pray. This verse 7, this is the third Isaiah's answer to Ezra and Nehemiah's culture war on those who didn't fit the national ideal. In his view, the Jerusalem temple was meant to be a world house, not a national shrine as every other temple in antiquity was. Yahweh welcomes whosoever desires to follow the way, regardless of who they are in their somatic or ethnic identity. Third Isaiah's perspective did not, however, prevail against the ethnocentric strategy of Ezra and Nehemiah. Indeed, many of those kicked out of the newly prescribed Judean body politic ended up as the despised Samaritans of Jesus' day. But God's word did not prove fruitless. More than four centuries later, a young Jesus of Nazareth, preaching his first sermon, looked hard at his audience and proceeded to read from the heart of 3rd Isaiah's oracle. And you can see here that Luke 4 parallels Isaiah 61. Jesus may have staked his entire ministry on a reappropriation of this prophetic tradition. He invokes it again at the culmination of his struggle with the public authorities in Jerusalem. In the midst of his dramatic exorcism of the temple, Jesus quotes directly from our text, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." And so, again, you can see Luke 19 parallels Isaiah 56. It was this vision of radical inclusion that animated Jesus' constant transgressions of social boundaries of his day. Eating with lepers, hanging out with women, touching the impure, teaching the excluded. More than anything else, it may have been what got him executed. Jesus most clearly addressed this issue in an overlooked parable found in Mark's Gospel. From chapter 7, there is nothing, in verse 15, there is nothing which goes into you that can defile you. Only that which comes out of you defiles you. This teaching is another prophetic skirmish with the social function of the purity code. Mark's Jesus is defending his disciples' practice of sharing table fellowship with the unclean outsider by insisting that what goes into a person's body from the outside cannot contaminate it. Mark presents this parable as one whose meaning the disciples must not miss. Jesus is proposing the physical body as a symbol of the body politic of the nation. Of course, Paul uses this same metaphor in 1 Corinthians 12:12, you know, the one body with many members. His point, which echoes exactly 3rd Isaiah's argument, is that the social boundaries constructed by an exclusionary purity code are powerless to protect the integrity of the community, which can only be truly be corrupted from within. And what may be at once his most radical and most widely ignored teaching, Jesus rejects all culturally proprietary boundaries that allegedly protect a community from perceived external threats. Scapegoating or excluding outsiders cannot protect us. We must look to our own ethical behavior. Only that which comes out of you defiles you. The episodes that immediately follow in Mark's narrative underscore the point. Jesus' own male and ethnic honor is challenged in the story of the Syrophoenician woman. In the sole gospel instance of Jesus losing a verbal joust, he concedes the justice of this female foreigner's insistence upon inclusion. And in Mark 8, the expanded circle of enfranchisement is then illustrated by the feeding of the Gentile multitudes. And notice it was in Gentile territory that those 4,000 were fed. Jesus then warns his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Herodians, which represents the social and political exclusivity that jeopardizes the one loaf around which the church is called to gather. To be sure, issues related to the continuing and often involuntary migration of peoples and to the geopolitical definition of human communities are complex in the modern world and deserve our careful reflection and deliberation. But these are finally theological and pastoral issues for Christians, and we must seek to know immigrants and refugees not as statistics, but as human beings who endure extraordinary hardship and trauma in their struggle to survive. And for U.S. citizens, these are issues of national identity. Israel's ethic of compassion towards outsiders was shaped by its own history of pain. You shall not wrong or oppress a resident alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. And it's from Exodus 22. We too are a nation of immigrants. Amidst the current culture wars that marginalize immigrants and refugees, then our churches must choose which America we embrace. To do that, we must hear and understand Jesus' teaching afresh, and that of the third Isaiah before him. If we refuse to take sides with today's outsiders, we too are without understanding. So that's as far as I wanted to go with the scriptures. There's a handout in front of you that on the one side has some resources. Resources are continually changing, so this list is good for a few days anyway. My suggestion is, if you're looking for sermon resources and you're looking in the near term, here's a good place to start, or study resources for your church. A few months from now, call us up or send us an email and a bunch of some other things, or check the webpage that's listed on there at the top. There are always new resources coming out. And as long as this is an important issue for the church, we'll keep working on it. And now I'd like to turn it over to Peter Pedamonte and Maria Weiler. I'll let them tell you what they're up to.
So we're going to listen to an audio clip of a story of actually one of our members who we work with, who is a young woman from Ecuador who left her home country when she was about 17 years old and embarked on a three-month journey to the U.S. And once she got here, she began working with a local community organization and works actively with us. So it's about a 5-minute story. I hope that's okay at 9 o'clock in the morning. But and then we'll have some time for discussion and kind of unpack that a little bit.
It is a very small village in the countryside up in the mountains. I left Ecuador on the day of September 3rd in the year 2000. I was 16 years old. I didn't have any place to live. I had my son. Often I didn't have anything to dress him in or anything to feed him. That was very sad for me. I wanted to find a better future for my son. I have not seen him for more than 7 years.
Empacó un par de camisas, un sombrero. Su vocación de aventurero, 6 consejos, 7 fotos, 1000 recuerdos.
Fue muy duro para mí, es un recuerdo muy triste, porque yo jamás... It was very hard for me, papá. A very sad memory, because I have never seen my father cry. The day I said goodbye, he gave me a big kiss and started to cry. He told me that he wanted to be able to see me one day, but he wasn't sure this would really happen because he's quite old. I didn't like to visit my parents' home in Sitkai. I went to their house and there I saw my mom looking in every corner for a cup of coffee to give me, because she didn't have any. It was something really hard for me to see how needy they were, and me with my arms crossed, not being able to do anything. I know that I am very far away, that I don't see them, and it makes me ache. But I know that my mother doesn't lack food to eat, she doesn't lack clothes to wear. As long as I exist, she won't need anything.
Empacó sus ganas de quedarse, su condición de transformarse en el hombre que soñó y no ha logrado.
Now things are very different for me, because through the years I have been able to study, I have been able to have a better job, I have been able to grow like a human being, I have been able to know that people of other races are kind and have a heart just like me. For me, it's not a job. It's like a home that I go to, where I am happy all day. It represents my struggle. It represents a reward for many things that have happened in my life. I believe that it means that dreams are possible. It means love for people, for my community. In reality, my dream is to be able to have my documents, get my status together, be with my two sons, studying really hard here. Me siento muy culpable yo cada vez que nos sentamos a cenar. I feel very guilty every time we sit down to have dinner. I see an empty space. Each time I go out on the street holding hands with my little son, I feel guilty for not having my other son. Christopher always tells me, I miss my brother. Why isn't my brother here? He thinks it's because we don't have any money. My son is 5 years old and he says, I want to work to bring my brother here, because he thinks it's for lack of money. I don't know how to explain the situation to him. En ese frío de invierno y en ese calor de verano está la gente afuera cortando grama, haciendo construcción. In the cold of winter and in the heat of summer, the people are outside, mowing grass, working in construction, sweating like crazy, trying to earn a miserable wage, being exploited. It's like modern slavery. Slavery has not ended. I have this great rage. I would like to have the power to make those people who want me to go back home to live my experiences and the experiences of thousands of people for 1 month. And I wanted to see if they can endure it. They don't know what this means and how much one aches, how much one suffers in this struggle. If I had the opportunity to be in front of someone who had the power to decide about the life of immigrants here in the United States, I would like to say to them that when they're about to make their decision, they close their eyes and put themselves in our place. In the place of millions of people, and that they think of how much we are suffering, and they see us as human beings struggling for a better life.
So, I thought we could start. I think we'd have a little space just for some discussion and to unpack that, a couple of the points in there, but maybe we can start with people's. If anyone has initial reactions or thoughts after listening to that, or what stood out for people in the story. for in the beginning, she talks about leaving her family. And she's like the pain of leaving behind and making that decision. I think for me, that always is really, like, always stands out really strongly for people making that decision. And I know so often in the heated debate about immigration, people, you know, not always talking about why people are coming here. And I think it's something to remember, and it's one thing that comes out in this story is that making that decision is really difficult. And nobody wants to leave their home, their family, their culture, their language, and come to a country where it's a new language, new culture, there's discrimination and exploitation. And obviously people come for many different reasons, whether it's political or religious persecution. In this case, we're talking about economic trade policies. And I think it's a really important part of the conversation in that, you know, policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and the structural adjustment programs really let down the protective trade barriers in the countries. And so small farmers, small businesses are left to compete with multinational corporations, which they can't compete with. And if you look in, like, Mexico, after NAFTA was passed in 94, the immigration went up by 100,000 from Mexico. And now 80% of the corn in Mexico is from the U.S., which basically swamped out all the smaller farmers. Another example would be in Nicaragua, where coffee is a big export product, but it costs about, after these economic policies, it costs a small farmer $55 to produce 100 pounds of coffee, but they can only sell it for $45 for the 100 pounds. And so they end up bringing in about $90 a month, but it costs about, on average, for a family of four or five, $425 a month to survive, which obviously we can't survive. So what happens is people move to the city, and the city, the work that's available there are the sweatshops, which pay about 13 cents an hour, I think, for a typical U.S. garment factory, which is about $14 a week. Again, in the city, it costs, I think, $29 a week for expenses for a family. That's not including, like, healthcare or dinner. And then that's when people are put into that situation, making that decision to move north. And when, you know, people have to make that, as Sarbelia shared, like, the decision to leave a child, which I can't imagine having to make that decision, but with the interest of giving them the opportunities. Are there any questions about that piece? And I think the second thing that always really strikes me is just the pain when she talks about sitting down at dinner. And so, just in case you didn't catch it, she has one son here, and then her other son, she left in Ecuador. And when she talks about sitting down to dinner, and every day it being so poignant that there's an empty chair there, always really hits me very hard. And I think it makes me think of all the, I mean, thinking 10, 12 million undocumented immigrants here, and all the people who are suffering with that separated family, and that can't bring the family over because of the immigration laws. And also on the flip side of that is the families who are separated because of deportations. And right now, there's about 1,100 people who are deported every day. Last year, it was 390,000, which is a steady increase in the last few years, that the Obama administration is continuing these policies of increased deportations. And I think, you know, the numbers, I think you can always just hear the numbers and they go right by you, but thinking about all those families who are torn apart, where mothers are deported or fathers are deported, and the rest of the family is left here, missing a parent, missing a wage earner, and really the trauma and and also as a country, how, you know, we always talk about family values and families are the key for society, but you know, we have an enforcement policy that rips that apart. And then I think the last thing at the part, how do people feel when she talks about modern day slavery? That's, like, accurate, a little bit of an exaggeration. Any reaction? Okay. it's interesting. I mean, with you know, I think the worker expectation. We talk to a lot of families who, you know, who work, and wage theft is a big issue where bosses don't pay them, and you know, if you don't have status, you don't have much leverage to or any power to work with, and people threaten to call immigration if they challenge them. There's people who've gotten injured at work, and the boss walks away. And also people working for really low wages and really awful working conditions. There's been a lot of cases. There was a tour, actually, of a modern-day slavery exhibit that came through the area, I think, like a couple months ago, from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida. And it was all about this idea of modern-day slavery, that looking at these instances in Florida where there's a labor company that provided labor to some of the really big producers, food producers in the States, and how they really kept people. People would come, they'd hire them, and then have a situation where people had to buy their food, all their supplies, alcohol from the boss. So they would end up being in debt to the boss and being paid miserable late wages, but always kept in debt, and also would not be allowed to leave. There's an instance of someone working, sitting in the fields with a shotgun. People who tried to flee and were caught and beaten or locked in trucks overnight so they wouldn't leave. And how this is, all this stuff is starting to come out, which is really awful. I think there's more information on it on the, if you look up the Coalition of Immokalee Workers on their website, there's some more information about it. Are there any questions? Did you want to?
Yeah, like this is a little bit more background to the story. Yeah, are there other comments about the story?
I was just thinking about how do we begin to have people sit together and speak about the theological, you know, differences, and you know, it's a complex issue. You know, it's theological, it's economical. We are part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think as a church community, we wrestle with the reality of welcoming the alien and the stranger. How we offer hospitality. And for some, you know, the fear that they're negating or violating, you know, other scripture, and so they feel caught. And it is polarizing, you know, in most of our churches and faith community. And I just think about how do we create places like this where we can really lay things out. And I think especially the economic factor is one that we're contributors to that as well. We aren't all in seats of power in the sense of, you know, approving legislation, but the need for legislative reform and so forth, I mean, that's just glaring at us. And I think some of our faith community doesn't see that, or don't want to look at it.
Yeah.
We're at a point here where dialogue has to happen, but we're so polarized and kind of stuck that we don't have a forum for that. Is that?
This is not very helpful, but Bob, I think that that display you have that shows disparity in wealth and the way it's growing, I think that fuels this, because it's as though the economic interests are constantly driving for lowest possible wages, which makes the immigrant community a valuable resource.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about it, but that's why I say it's not very helpful. But it just strikes me that that's part of the dynamic.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the economy has always searched out the lowest, the cheapest, and most exploitable group labor pool. And the same reason, like, why, you know, companies first moved to Mexico and then have left them and gone to, you know, to Southeast Asia. But yeah, I mean, even in this country, you know, we have cheap tomatoes because there's farm workers who will, you know, work 18 or 13, 14 hours a day for very little money. That's a big question. Go ahead.
Well, just to kind of piggyback off of that, I feel like you know, our lifestyles, our society, it's kind of like a big machine that keeps running, and you always need this, like, almost highly exploitable, nearly slave class of people to run that machine. And so, yeah, I mean, we can make better laws, but a lot of it has to do, I feel, with just employers, you know, treating people better, and consumers, like, being more concerned.
So part of the reason this issue is such a big issue to tackle is because it touches on so many parts of our lives and how we, what we buy and what stores we go to, and all of those things also play into this, including our faith and who we talk to and all of those things too.
If kind of getting back to what you were saying, Warren, how kind of getting it back into the church setting of, yeah, we can't change all of those things as much as we would like to. But I also think some of the rub comes, and I will speak from more of a ethnic white Mennonite, some of the rub is cultural as well. I mean, we know that about ourselves, white ethnic Mennonites, going into other settings doing mission and not understanding why they don't work harder and get more done in our time frame. I mean, I just think in some of the immigration stories, then we're also not understanding, they're not living up to our standards of, well, if you would do this, you could get out of that, or if you would do that, you know, I mean, it is understanding some of the economic situations that they're in, and some of the, they don't have the resources that we think about having, but I also think there's an underlying thing that we just keep coming up against, and that's not to demoralize or demonize us, but just to, that we need to keep recognizing that when we work with anyone outside of, any one of us outside of our own home culture, we take our expectations of what a good worker looks like, what, you know, how you need to go through the steps to make something work. We always impose our own. It's just human nature, and I think that's some of the underlying stuff in the church as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this definitely ties into an issue that's been talked about a lot recently, and we're still really struggling with about. I know many of you are from families that have been Mennonite Anabaptist for a long time, and I know some of you are from other families that are coming in, and this is a big clash in our church that we're having trouble dealing with, and it's going to take a lot of work, and this definitely ties in with that.
Yeah, and I think what you said about opening spaces to have, we've been thinking about that a lot lately, about, you know, how to create those spaces where people feel safe to really talk or have those frank discussions, and also, you know, with these spaces where, you know, the different cultures and different groups can have a dialogue and start building those relationships. I think just as we were talking beforehand about, you know, churches who've worked with refugees or anything, really those building those relationships have been transformative. And, you know, how do we create those spaces to do that?
I just think having a story, you know, it's interesting. I mean, that kind of puts it on a very personal level, and I just think that's really powerful, because once you build a relationship with a person and hear their story, you have a totally different perspective, totally different, and it just makes you hungry. You just have compassion that you didn't have before.
Yeah.
And so that breaks down those walls, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Next Sunday, there are some people from my church, from Philadelphia Praise Center, some immigrants who are going over to Ken Burkholder's congregation, Deep Run East, to share some of those stories with them. And that's something that we're very welcome to happening, to have happen on a wider scale also. If other congregations are wanting to engage in those stories and have a mutual sharing time, those are the kinds of things that this conference structure is really helpful with. And so we have this great resource, and we have all of these people with different stories in our conference. And Yeah, we just need to look for them.
Just to piggyback on that, yeah, we're doing a 2-week study at Deep Run East on immigration, which we started this past week, and like Maria said, we're going to have some people coming to share their stories. We've had a Sunday school discussion time, your question, Warren, about the polarization, just to have time to talk about these issues. I think it went pretty well this past week, but it's clear, not surprisingly, that, you know, there's a variety of perspectives. And I guess the questions that, and things I've read about immigration, and questions that came up in our Sunday school class, you know, the two issues that people often point to are the law and the border, the law and the border. And how can we talk about those in ways that are helpful? I'd be curious your response. You know, people, that was the issue. Well, you know, the breaking the law and border control, those two issues. And I know I've read some things how to talk about that, but I'd be curious what other responses there would be, because they seem to be the two places where there's real pushback.
Yeah, let me just grab a chart really quick.
That's a great transition. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we want to talk about some of those difficult questions that people are having. Because if we don't actually talk about them, then people aren't going to feel like they're heard, and no one will actually engage in a dialogue. So do you want to start with that?
Yeah, this is like, to talk about the law, that's a really good way to start. And for me, I was like, immigration law is so complex, so complicated. It's like, how do you even begin to get your head around it? And this chart, I think, is great to start doing that, to kind of understand also, like my parents, both my parents are immigrants, and my father's from Italy, and my aunts, and the thing they're stuck on is like, well, why don't they come legally? You know, why don't they follow the law? We came through the proper channels, right? But what I think the thing that we don't understand is that if you're a low-wage worker, if you're an unskilled worker, there is no way to come. There is no line to get into. And this basically kind of goes through legal immigration. And the quickest way to get through is if you have a relative that's a U.S. citizen and you have to be a parent, spouse, or minor child. And still the backlog to get to citizenship, it's still years and years. And it still says 6 to 7 years to become a citizen through that path. The other way is if you're like a soccer star or some kind of genius or have a ton of money. But if you don't have skills, if you're a laborer or whatever, there's many, when you go through the process, first of all, like in Mexico, it costs, I think, $70 or $100 to even apply for a visa, which is prohibitive for anyone. It's also a lot of times like a day trip on the bus to even go to the office to do it. So people can't afford that. And in a lot of countries, you know, they're going to grill you to see if they can find any reason that they may suspect that you're coming here to stay. They're not going to let you, they're not going to give you a visa. So, for example, the way to prove that is you have to have land or property and a certain amount of money in a bank account. So that excludes a lot of people. So when there is no way to come through the proper channels, that's when people cross over or cross the border. And I have a few copies of this on a smaller scale that I can pass around later, but it's a good way to just kind of like explore a little bit and be able to wrap your head around those laws a little bit.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about this one, or difficult thing, is that like even if you can come through, or even if you do fit into some of these categories, there are still ways that you can become ineligible. Like if you're related to a lawful permanent resident, but you are, but you're married, then you don't apply. If you are not the spouse or child of a lawful permanent resident, sorry, you can't. If you don't have a job offer, then you can't come through the skilled labor channel. Or if your employer is not willing to sponsor you, that's another way. I mean, there are just so many ways that you can fall out of this process. And like I said, it can take 30 years to become a citizen. Like it's an incredible process, and it's.
The problem with that, what I'm hearing, is that it seems to me that the counter could be, Well, all you're saying is it's difficult, and the implication being make it less difficult. And the counter question to that is why should we make it less difficult? There are laws there for a reason. And then it seems to counter what the myth says. Most immigrants across the board are illegal. Well, around 75% of today's immigrants have legal permanent immigrant visas, and 25% are undocumented. 40% only stay temporary non-immigrant visas. So, on the one hand, this paper is saying it's a myth that most immigrants are illegal. But that's trying to say, oh, it's very, very difficult, and so it seems like most would be illegal. Mm-hmm. Can't have it both ways.
I think that's what I think the paper is saying, that most, even if someone's undocumented, doesn't mean they crossed the border. Like, that doesn't mean they came here illegally, but that they, you know, their paperwork has expired.
That's maybe addressing more the issue of the border.
And I think that brings up a discussion of what, you know, evaluating the law. And, you know, talking about our history as a country, that, you know, the laws have become much, much tighter. And, you know, we still have a labor shortage in a country of low-wage jobs. And, you know, on one hand, there's the job market. And then on the other hand, there's this law that's not letting people in. But I think it gets into, like, well, is this a just law? And what is the point of it, of having such a restrictive law, and especially, you know, as Christians, how are we, what's our perspective on this law?
I think that's the way I would approach it. When somebody raised the question, well, they're coming in here illegally, and they're breaking the law, they're speaking as if the law is some divine ordained, mm-hmm. you know, breaking God's holiness. This is a human-made law.
Yeah.
And we're breaking some of the humans, and we can always change it. And I think we need to speak at that level. What's behind the attitude of using the law as a defense? And then we get underneath the law itself. I think
yeah.
that's the approach.
And that's
the Corinthians 13 issue, if you're from a
Yeah, that's interesting, because it is a big... I feel like that the word illegal is such a block that I think is really challenging for people.
What about the second part of that, border control? Can you talk a little bit about border security and humane border control?
Border is a big issue. So when did that border start? 1846? 1847? It's 150 years old. There's a lot more Mexico back then. So just as a, you know, I think it's important to framework that we've set these borders, again, going back to human-made lines in the sand. Besides that, though, the border, yeah, is a big issue. I don't think, you know, and that's where, especially after 9/11, they've equated immigration with terrorism. And so often you hear in those two words in the same sentence, and I think that's really dangerous, and it's playing on people's fear. You know, of a really awful tragedy on 9/11. But, you know, everyone who was, those terrorists all were here with papers. They all had visas. They didn't cross through Mexico. The border, you know, there's been, last year there was 206 deaths crossing the border as they militarized the border, so as they build more fences, start using drones, send the military down there. All it does is push people farther out. So where people crossed before, now they're just crossing far out into the desert. So people are dying of dehydration, exhaustion, getting lost in the desert. And I think this summer when it was really hot, I think they've already had 150 deaths in the desert of found stuff. So the problem is it's not stopping the tide. It's just pushing people into more dangerous situations.
One issue I see is that, or one way to look at it, I guess, is that when people come, they weigh the benefits and the risks, kind of their coming. Well, it's this dangerous to cross the border. I'll have this many problems when I come. I definitely can't get citizenship if I come illegally. Things like that, with I can feed my family if I come. I can actually work to be a useful citizen of the world, of wherever I'm living, if I come. Things like that. For some people, they're escaping a situation of abuse or domestic violence or a gang that's trying to recruit them. These things are all things that they're trying to weigh. And here, we're our approach is often, as the United States, to raise those risks, to say, well, you'll have to go further into the desert if you want to come. You'll have to, the issue of citizenship. If you get caught driving without a driver's license, which you can't get if you're undocumented, then you're going to get deported right away and you won't be able to come back for 10 years. We raise these risks, but the reasons people come, the advantages, are still really high. People really need to come. Or I guess to look at it the other way, the risks of staying home are still even higher. So one thing that Peter was talking about when he was talking about the trade barriers and people being able to make a living in their home countries is if we can lower those risks of staying home, if we can make it possible for people to actually live in their home countries, they're not going to come here. They don't want to come here, but they have to. And so that's one way that I look at it.
The border is a huge issue. I don't know if that was.
Yeah, no, it's, I guess, yeah, the question as Christians, yeah, is there a place for some border control? If so, what should that look like? I mean, I don't know. It's messy.
Yeah. And real quick, I mean, I remember looking at a map, and it was talking about walls being built in the world.
Right.
You know, and, you know, as Christians, how do we feel about the U.S.-Mexico border being one of those places? Along with Israel and Palestine, and you know, we're building a wall.
So I think Peter and Maria are. I noticed in the paper this morning two issues. One is the Cambodian community in Philadelphia are being focused on deportation. And secondly, I noticed this morning that Philadelphia, of the 10 largest cities, is the poorest. Are there unique issues to this issue out of the 2009 census of the 10 largest cities? Philadelphia is the poorest. Are there unique issues to this region with this issue of the difficult questions affecting immigrant populations unique to Philadelphia region? You hopefully hear that. Because borders, yeah, I mean, it's an important issue, but what about the folks that are being affected? Indonesian population, Cambodian population?
The particular issue with the Cambodian population, and maybe you can back me up on this, is that recently the U.S. government and the Cambodian government have made an agreement to...
I think the Cambodia has agreed to accept, like they've made a deal where they can deport people, and immigration has, you know, so it's a much farther flight, so they've rented, or they've hired 3 planes to go to Cambodia, and now they're really focusing in to fill those planes, so they have a full flight when they go home. So Philadelphia is, I think, the second biggest Cambodian population in the States, and so they're really going after people to deport them.
This is also happening in Vietnam and I think some other countries as well.
These are people who came on refugee status and are here legally and have citizenship, even some of them, but they have gotten involved in or been accused of a crime.
Yeah,
and they're being deported. Repatriated, it's called.
Yeah. So one example was one man was when he was a teen or whatever got involved I think with some gang activity and went to jail and served like 10 years. Came out and this was 15 years ago and he has a family now. He's also working with inner city youth to make sure they don't go down the same path he went down. And since he was convicted of a crime, that violated his status. And the law is retroactive, so it doesn't matter when, as long as you did. So he was deported in the beginning of September. And this is happening. And his was more of a serious crime, but there's also people who, you know, like shoplifting is now a deportable offense, would violate their status. Yeah.
I've just got to share, this past week, a couple of us, a few of us, were in the room when Elizabeth Soto Albrecht from Lancaster shared a wonderful message, a call for the Christian community to begin to walk the wall, to walk the edge, to begin to comprehend the complexity, I think, of Maria, what you were describing, you know, the pros and cons. You were there, but I was trying to remember the book that she referenced. That was just a powerful message to the Christian community. She's a Columbia and ordained a Mennonite minister on the staff of Jackson Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
These stories are here. They're in our church. I could share several similar stories to the one that we heard here in Philadelphia Praise Center. There's a woman right now whose grandson, who was just born a couple weeks ago, is sick in Mexico, but she can't come visit, and she hasn't seen this baby yet, but she came because there's no work in her town. Nobody has a job. And they used to farm beans. They were basically subsistence farmers, but they used to be able to sell some of the harvest, and they haven't been able to. So she had to come here to find work. And yeah, I mean, these stories are all over the Mennonite Church.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece of immigration is also the children that are being raised. If their parents don't have any legal status, they have no way to get legal status. We have that experience in our congregation as well, and so they can be in their 20s, 30s, have no way to have a job, have no road. Really, to get legal, I mean, there's not, that's what the DREAM Act is all about. But then, you know, I mean, you talk about the parents coming over, but then even raising children, unless they were born here, that's different. But even if they come over at 6 months of age and this is the only country they know, they're stuck.
Yeah.
I think another discussion we need to have within the church on this issue is that I think we react more American than Christian. Mm-hmm. And we have to reverse that. Much of our attitude comes out of our ownership of being Americans and worrying about our American prosperity, security, safety, comfort, etc. Instead of coming out of what was Christian first, which means we're citizens of the kingdom of God, primarily, and only secondarily are we citizens of whatever country we happen to be born and raised in, and that we ought to have our principles and our actions that come out of our principles coming out of the Christian value of being members of the kingdom of God, which would have us act differently than a citizen who sees himself or herself as a citizen of whatever.
And I think, you know, that goes back to what you're saying about the book walking that, and like that's the challenge for us. But it's an exciting, I think it's a really exciting piece, and I think it also allows us to say what we're for, you know, instead of always reacting to like, well, they're illegal or whatever, but really talk about what the kingdom is and what we're called to do as Christians and what that world and that life looks like.
I want to keep talking just a little bit more about the challenges that people are having with this issue or the difficult questions that people are bringing up. Just a little bit longer. So, go ahead.
It strikes me, I find within myself a struggle to sort of come up with a good policy, which is kind of a joke because it's very complex, and even if I could, it wouldn't make any difference because. But that's a struggle. It seems. But the other side of it is, I can talk to people. And I think the great commandments of love God and love your neighbor. If we're going to love our neighbor, we have to talk to them. So we can talk to people. That's something we all can do. And the policy stuff, I don't know what's going to happen to that. We can be part of that, maybe, but. We can talk to people in the meantime. that are affected. We can talk to immigrants in our own communities.
Mm-hmm. And we can also talk to the people who have these questions.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and have those discussions.
And they can talk to the immigrants.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or even have that discussion as Christians. Like.
Sure.
Is there anything set up, sort of like the Christian peacemaker movement, where there's groups of people that actually go? Like, I'm just thinking, does anybody even have these conversations in the big machine when, you know, with people that make these laws, with people that enforce the laws, with people that are there where that's happening? Are there groups of people that are going in and just trying to have a face be put on the people that are coming rather than just, you know what I'm saying, going in and trying to create that kind of understanding in the areas where people do have the power, where maybe these stories aren't being allowed to get through? Like, are there ways to have that kind of presence?
I guess there are several different things that are happening, and I'm not sure if they quite address what you're talking about, but if not, please say so. There are smaller scale things happening with people who come from an immigrant background and people who maybe come from a further back immigrant background, are getting together to share their stories and talk about things, and that way the story is getting heard. There also is a project, Tell the Story project.
Yeah, we're in Philadelphia and in actually Bucks, Montgomery in Philadelphia County. There's a program called Secure Communities, which links the local police's database with immigration. So whenever anyone's arrested for whatever reason, even if it's driving without a license, their information is immediately passed to immigration. And immigration will call, put a hold on them in the prison, and then come pick them up. And the problem with that is immigration will say this is going after terrorists, drug traffickers, human traffickers, the worst of the worst. But in reality on the ground, it's, even by immigration's own statistics, about 78% of the people who are deported through this program are non-criminals, which means they were not convicted or the charges were thrown out, or very low level violations. It's really going after really these, you know, very, you know, like a bar fight or a traffic incident or whatever. But it also, this happens right way before conviction, right when you're booked, so people never have their day in court. It also creates a lot of fear in the community, which is actually, we're already talking about a very vulnerable community. And then you add this to it, and people are pushed farther into the shadows, and they also don't trust the police. And you know, the police departments always talk about that key element of community trust. When we don't have that, people aren't going to call when they're a victim or a witness. It also encourages racial profiling. But in Philadelphia, we've started a storytelling project where we record stories like this, but specific about this issue. And as a process to organize in the community, but also to take those stories to the decision makers. And like last June, a group of people who shared their stories went through a process of, you know, political analysis and looking at the issue. And we had a forum where the people from the mayor's office and the DA's office were able to listen to these stories and hear why they needed to stop these programs. It is an exciting, I think getting the stories to the decision maker is really important, but also, you know, for us, it's been a really exciting process to be part of.
This is also an issue that the MCC Washington office has a pretty strong role in. I'm not sure exactly what their process is with that, but it's one of the issues that they're focusing on.
A couple of comments. One of the things I've learned in working with immigration and with MCC is that, first of all, the faith community and working as a faith community is something that is really important when talking about these kinds of issues. it's just huge. And I think, first of all, having these conversations as a congregation, having these kinds of studies, talking about them is the place to start. But the second thing, when it comes to beginning to do advocacy, one of the things that we're learning is that immigration advocacy, really, Washington is not the place to start, but local and state. Because right now, that's where it's being fueled from. And local and state issues are really important to build the base community and to help address local issues and state issues. And then, hopefully, you know, we will get immigration reform, but it's gonna happen, first of all, at local and state levels. And so that's where I think that, you know, we can be encouraged to begin to act as people of faith and Christians.
And there are already in the Pennsylvania state legislature some insidious laws that are in the process. So if we have more time, we can talk about it.
And that's where I think it really comes to, what are people saying in your congregations about this issue? How are people feeling? And how can we talk about this in a way that recognizes people's worries and fears and explains, gets the information out there, and helps people to understand our calling as Christians.
Is there any way that we can help people think about how larger corporations, like global corporations, feed into this problem? And can we do something about that on a local level? I think about even places like Walmart and Nestle, Nestle, Coca-Cola, how they go into these countries, third world countries, pay people 13 cents an hour, which makes them need to come up here. And how does, like, buying locally, you know, work? I mean, how do you work with that? It feels really complex and big, but what are the little things that we can do and talk about and make people more aware?
You know, I think just the first thing of drawing, make connecting those dots. You know, when you look at NAFTA, I mean, it really hurt Mexico. It also, we lost a lot of jobs here. But then when those same workers who were forced to leave come up here, there, you know, there's a lot of friction between the workers who lost their jobs. And, you know, I think having those spaces to talk about, you know, like, where the real problem is coming from. And then, you know, I'm not sure about, you know, the actual concrete work besides, you know, like buying local or food co-ops and stuff, but.
And just being aware, Coca-Cola has a whole bunch of different names that it uses for its different products, just things like that. Change happens when the consumers say, I'm not gonna buy this product because I don't feel good about it. And that's how we can affect things. That's one way we can affect things. Yeah, just one final thing here. I know we have to hurry and close up here, but I really appreciate the way all of you are taking into account like what's happening in your congregations and trying to find a way to talk about this in a healthy way. And I think it's really important that the pastors and leaders of the congregations, you know, take that temperature and then are the ones who can remind people of our role as Christians, not to be comfortable and not to stand still, but to change and to grow into what the kingdom of God will be. It's not an easy process, but it's a necessary process, and it's what we need to do to be faithful.
So we do need to wrap up. A couple of quick announcements. This is a start of a good conversation. We'd like to continue the conversation, and November 20th at Towaminson Church, we are planning to go ahead with the planning for that. We would welcome your comments, suggestions, what should be included, and then we'll have biblical discussion. We'll have, you know, folks there who work with immigrants. We'll have immigrants there for conversation, but we need your input as well as to, you know, what makes it a useful day for you. Are there other topics that we haven't touched on here that, you know, that, that should be part of that? Also, coming up in February, our annual Winter Peace Retreat, we have Rick Ufford-Chase. Rick and his family spent 20 years living on the Arizona border, working with immigrants coming across the border. Rick is currently executive director of the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, but that comes back to Mike's questions. You know, are other folks who raise what's happening on the border, how do we deal with those issues? So this will be a chance for some firsthand conversation. So thank you all for coming. Please call on us if we can be further help on this issue.
Let's give Bob, Peter, and Maria a round of applause.